Good morning. If you have your Bible, go ahead and turn to Luke chapter 14. That'll be the text we'll be looking at this morning and taking our lesson from, Luke chapter 14. As you're turning there, let me read you some things that came from some comment cards given to the various staff members at the various parks in our National Park Service. All of these comment cards come from the year 1996, so they're not that old. But there is something about them. Now, keep in mind that the National Park Service has as its mandate to try, while providing for people to be able to enjoy nature, trying to keep nature as much untouched as possible. So here are some of these comment cards, all right? Trails need to be reconstructed. Please avoid building trails that go uphill. Too many bugs and leeches and spiders and spider webs. Please spray the wilderness to rid the areas of these pests. I like this one. Please pave the trails. Chair lifts need to be in some places so that we can get to wonderful views without having to hike to them. The coyotes made too much noise last night and kept me awake. Please eradicate these annoying animals. A small deer came into my camp and stole my jar of pickles. Is there any way I can get reimbursed? Please call, and then that's the phone number. Escalators would help on steep uphill sections. A McDonald's would be nice at the trailhead. There are too many rocks in the mountains. Now, the list goes on and on. You can probably find a list on the internet with a lot more that you can look at that are just funny to read. But there's something sad about it too, because these comments and complaints indicate that the people who made them do not really understand what it means to be in a wilderness area. They were looking for something convenient and something comfortable, not truly a wilderness experience. And I think in a similar way, many people today do not understand what it means to be a genuine disciple of Christ, a Christian. There are multitudes that often follow Jesus or claim to be Christian who do so on their own terms and not on His terms. And I don't believe they understand truly the biblical definition of discipleship. And because of this ignorance, there are many who consider themselves to be followers of Jesus who are not, even though in many ways they might look like true followers of Jesus Christ. They go to church, they have a profession of faith, they might read their Bibles, they even give in the collection, but they are not the real deal, or at least they're not living and thinking like the real deal. And that's the issue that Jesus confronts in our text this morning. He makes a very, very clear statement about what it means to be a disciple of His, to be a Christian. And therefore, there is no reason for anybody to be ignorant or self-deceived, because He makes it clear that if you're going to be a Christian, you're going to be a disciple of mine, here's how it works. Now, we'll take a look at how Jesus defined discipleship in a moment, but when we go over this text verse by verse. But before I do that, I want to remind you that we have been looking at this concept of disciple, which is repeated many, many times in the gospel accounts. And we understand some basics. We understand that a disciple is a follower of Jesus Christ. We even understand that the word disciple at its basic meaning means learner. And we even understand that the two terms disciple and Christian essentially mean the same thing, or they're supposed to mean the same thing, because disciples were called Christians first at Antioch. And we know that the term disciple occurs 260 some odd times in the New Testament, and the term Christian only occurs 3 times in the New Testament. But what we've been talking about is the fact that in our modern world, the word disciple is not fully understood. And so we've been looking at some of the texts in order to help us understand from the viewpoint of Jesus himself, what does it mean to be a disciple? Now, that's what we're looking, or we're doing, as we look at this very brief passage. Now, let's take a look again at the passage that was read earlier. Now, in verse 25 of Luke chapter 14, it says, "Now great multitudes went with him, and he turned and said to them, 'If anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, wife and children, his brothers and sisters, yes, and his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. And whoever does not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple.'" Now let's stop right there. With this very brief statement, Jesus makes some important points, or actually makes one basic overriding point. But the first thing I want you to notice is to whom Jesus is speaking these words about being a disciple. Luke notes specifically that a large crowd or a multitude have come out with him. They're following Jesus, and Jesus specifically turns to them, the multitude, the large crowd. And Jesus is specifically talking and elaborating on what it means to be a disciple to this large crowd. Now, Jesus was not, let's picture this, he is not talking to those who were antagonistic towards him. They aren't in this section. He is not talking about those who are relatively uninterested in his message or his life. No, these are people who the text says are went with him. Now, that phrase, went with him, implies that they've been following him for a while. That they are that in the thinking of the Jewish first century people, these people were determined that they were going to make Jesus their leader. They were going to follow him. And so they're positive in their attitude toward Jesus. They're interested in what he has to say. They're willing to take a hike and go with him as he travels throughout the countryside. They are very much interested, and they probably think that they are being disciples of Jesus. They apparently have mistaken their positive attitude and their interest in Jesus for true discipleship, as many people do today. They consider themselves probably to be followers of Jesus, but in reality, they're only casual followers, and they're not truly disciples. They were willing, they're even anxious to follow Jesus, providing the cost is not too high. They're like many people today who do Christian things like go to church and pray and sing Christian songs, but they're not really committed to Jesus on an everyday basis. In a sense, they were along for the ride, but they are unwilling, apparently, to give up those things that conflict with following Jesus in a committed way. And I think, again, they're like many people today who look to Jesus to solve their money problems or their relationship problems or their health problems, but who quickly grow disillusioned and unwilling to obey Christ completely when following Jesus doesn't solve those problems or following requires some real sacrifices in their lives. These large crowds, you see, were not committed followers. And what we're going to have to do as individuals, as we look at this, is we're going to have to determine, where do we fit in? Are we among the people in the large crowd? Or are we among those who will take what Jesus says and apply it? Now, Jesus turns and he addresses this mistaken understanding of discipleship in verses 26 and 27. And he explains in very vivid and clear terms what it means to be a disciple of his. And in summary, Jesus' message in those two verses is very simple. It is this: to be a disciple of Jesus, you must be committed to Him above everything else. In our hearts, Jesus must come before our loved ones, before our self-interest, before our possessions, before our career, before our hobbies, before our goals in life, even before our very lives. In practice, this commitment to Jesus will be tested, and sometimes in a moment of weakness, Jesus will not come first in our choices, but genuine disciples have a sincere commitment in their hearts that they will not continue to put other things before Jesus. They will decide that Jesus comes first. In verse 26, Jesus says this commitment level applies to anyone who comes to me. In other words, Jesus is not speaking specifically to, speaking exclusively to a special group of Christians such as apostles or evangelists or missionaries or elders or deacons or even mature believers. He is saying that this principle is one that is supposed to apply to everyone who would be one of His followers. If you're going to be a follower, you have to understand this principle applies to you. And then he goes on to say, anyone who comes to me and does not hate. Now, the word hate here is not meant to be taken literally, but is rather used figuratively to express a point. That's the way it was used in the first century world among Jewish rabbis. It is what we would call, and I looked it up so that I would actually get the right term, hyperbole. It is an exaggerated statement to express something. We use the same way when we say, "Boy, that man was as big as a house." You know, talking about how someone is rather large. I've been described as being as big as a mountain sometimes, but you know, nevertheless, in Jewish culture, the word hate was used many, many times in its literature that we have from that day to express lesser love. So Jesus is saying that we must love Him much more than we love our closest family relationships or even our own lives. We must love Him more than father or mother or wife or children or brothers or sisters, even our own lives. That means more than our hobbies, more than our goals in life, more than our careers, more than any self-interest. And Jesus is not speaking of our emotional feelings toward Him or our families, but rather He's speaking of our level of commitment. He's saying that our commitment to obey and following Him must be greater than our commitment to anything else in our lives. In other words, Jesus is saying He must be first in our priorities. He must be first in our loyalties. He must be first in everything if we're going to be His disciple. Is that true in your life? It's not true in my life all the time. For instance, if following Jesus obediently results in problems or interferes with your closest relationships, will you still follow Him? This is not a hypothetical situation. In some countries, following Jesus can sometimes mean being kicked out of your family. It can mean losing your children. It can mean imprisonment. It can mean actually losing your life. In our own country, many relationships have encountered problems because one spouse is a committed Christian and the other is not. And in such cases, Jesus wants us to know up front what it means to be a disciple. He's saying, to be a disciple of Jesus, you must be committed to Him above everything else. We must not only love or be committed to Jesus more than our loved ones, but we also must be committed to Him above even our own lives, he says in verse 26. And that refers to our physical lives, with which we must be willing to surrender for the sake of Jesus. It also refers to our self-lives, which means our personal desires, our goals, our interests, even our needs. We must be committed to Jesus above our bank accounts, above our public image, above our jobs, above our personal desires. And if following Jesus means forfeiting those things, then we have to be willing to do so. Again, it's not a hypothetical. It is a fact that following Jesus many times, in many places, and in many ways means making exactly such a sacrifice. So, to be a disciple of Jesus, you must be committed to Him above everything else. Then Jesus uses another metaphor in verse 27 to reemphasize this point. Everybody present in the first century world was familiar with what Jesus was referring to when he talked about carrying his cross. The cross in the first century world was a cruel form of punishment used by the Romans. The criminal was, or political captive was forced to carry his cross to his place of execution. Everybody knew that this person was saying goodbye to everything. There would be no turning or coming back. And it's this vivid illustration with the intent of showing that following him requires the same kind of saying goodbye to our own will and our own desires because of our commitment to follow him that Jesus is emphasizing as he says, "Whoever does not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple." Now some might think that this requirement of total commitment to be a follower of Jesus is contradictory to the scriptural truth that salvation is a free gift of God. Let me see if I can give you an illustration that might help clarify the issue. Suppose... Now, I don't really have such a desire, but suppose I did. Suppose I had the desire to climb Mount Everest. Now, I really don't have such a desire, and I think that those who do have such a desire are probably either gifted in ways that I'm not or lacking in ways that I'm not. Either way, I'm not one of those who's ever going to climb Mount Everest. But suppose I did have the desire to climb Mount Everest, but it cost about $70,000 to do it. And I don't have that kind of money. But now suppose a wealthy businessman heard of my desire and he offered to pay for the entire expedition. He would buy all the expensive clothing. He would buy all the gear. He would pay for my transportation. He would pay for my guides. He would pay for my training. It would be totally free for me. But if I accept his free offer, I have just committed myself to months of difficult training and to the actual climbing of Mount Everest, haven't I? Well, in the same way, that's what Jesus is saying about following him. If we want the free gift of salvation in Jesus Christ, it's there. But taking and accepting that gift implies that we're going to follow him. And Jesus makes it clear that following him has some cost. Take a look at the next couple of verses, verses 28 through 33, all right? "For which of you, intending to build a tower, does not sit down first and count the cost, whether he has enough to finish it? Lest after he has laid the foundation and is not able to finish, all who see it begin to mock him, saying, 'This man began to build and was not able to finish.' Or what king going to make war against another king does not sit down first and consider whether he is able with 10,000 to meet him who comes against him with 20,000? Or else, while the other is still a great way off, he sends a delegation and asks conditions of peace. So likewise, whoever of you does not forsake all that he has cannot be my disciple." In these two illustrations, Jesus is expressing one simple, very pertinent point. His point is that just like it is prudent, wise to consider the cost involved in building a tower or going to war before jumping in with both feet, so it is prudent and wise and necessary to take into account the cost and commitment of following Jesus. Jesus doesn't want people to make a commitment to Him without understanding and seriously thinking about what is involved in the decision. He does not want a half-hearted, blind commitment that expects only blessings. He wants us to know there is a cost. There's a commercial that ran on TV, I don't know how long ago it was, I haven't seen it recently, but it has a man sitting in the chair at a tattoo parlor, and he's expressing his love to his girlfriend Donna by getting her name tattooed on her arm. Halfway through the procedure, he asks how much is it going to cost? And the tattoo artist is saying, well, the total cost is $50. Now, keep in mind, the tattoo artist isn't done, and so, but the guy who's getting the tattoo stops him for a minute, pulls out his wallet, counts his cash, and says, oh, I only have $41. Then the scene cuts to the couple on the sidewalk, and Donna is storming off with the guy yelling after her, I'll get it fixed, I'll get it fixed! And then the camera zooms in on the tattoo, and the tattoo reads, I love Dawn. He didn't count the costs beforehand, did he? Instead of Donna, it said Dawn. The commercial showed the foolishness of considering the cost of something so irrevocable halfway through. One should consider and make sure one is willing to pay the cost prior to making the commitment. Jesus wants us to ask ourselves, am I in this for the long haul? Why? Because to be a disciple of Jesus, you must be committed to Him above everything else. Now that's not like many people today, including many preachers who are only interested in large crowds. Jesus was not interested in numbers. Large crowds didn't impress Him. But what He wanted was a totally committed person. In fact, Jesus doesn't want crowds. He wants commitment. The condition of much of the church today indicates that we have many who are just part of the crowd and not true disciples. There are many who have not listened to Jesus and considered the cost. The total commitment is lacking even though a profession of faith might be present. That's why recent polls show little difference between the way the world lives and the way those who profess to be Christians live. For example, recent polls show that those who call themselves Christians are just as likely as non-Christians to be divorced. The fact is, there's actually a little bit of a hedge toward those who are Christians divorcing over the world. It is just as likely for those who profess to be Christians to be involved in stealing from their employer as those who are not. It is just as likely as those who claim to be Christians to lie on their tax returns as those who are not. Another example that demonstrates this lack of commitment happened in Washington, D.C. Not too many years ago, but on one particular year when Palm Sunday came. Palm Sunday is a big celebration for a great many denominational churches. But the city of Washington, D.C. scheduled a marathon on Palm Sunday, which greatly interfered with normal traffic during a small window of time in the morning. The leaders of those various churches were upset and made their feelings known in the local papers. In fact, as many churches reported after that Sunday, that their attendance was down 50 to 70% on that day. And they blamed the marathon. Was it not possible to get to their church service on that day? Well, the race did delay traffic by about 15 to 30 minutes if you waited for the traffic, the race to pass by, or 15 to 20 minutes if you took an alternate route around the race. And yet, 50 to 70% of regular church attendees were, by their own admission that day, unwilling to take the extra time or fight the traffic to get to a church service because they didn't think it was worth it. Now, such an attitude doesn't seem fitting for true disciples who are supposed to be willing to give their lives to follow Jesus, does it? These kinds of things, these moral compromise, half-hearted commitment, would not be happening if people really understood what was required of disciples, if they had considered the cost as Jesus instructed. And in fact, in verse 33, Jesus again says, "So likewise, whoever of you does not forsake all that he has cannot be my disciple." In other words, the disciple must be willing to give up everything. Everything's a fairly inclusive word, isn't it? Everything means everything. Everything means your cushy job, your favorite hobby, your most prized possessions, your free time, your money, your goals, your dreams, and more. And we may not literally give up everything, but Jesus is referring to an attitude of the heart in which these things don't have priority over obeying Jesus in our lives. See, the Greek word translated give up can also be translated say goodbye or renounce. In other words, Jesus says that we must be willing to renounce or forsake anything when it might interfere with following Him faithfully and completely. Why? Because to be a disciple of Jesus, you must be committed to Him above everything else. And then he goes on, he says in verse 34 and 35, "Salt is good, but if the salt has lost its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is neither fit for the land nor for the dunghill, but men throw it out. He who has ears to hear, let him hear." Now salt was routinely used by Jesus in figurative ways because of the high value people placed on salt in ancient times. Salt was used as a preservative, used as a flavoring agent, used as a fertilizer. Salt in this case represents a person's commitment to Jesus. And when the commitment is complete, then the salt is good. That means that the Christian's life will have a positive, useful purpose in the same way as good salt did for the people of that day. Salt in Jesus' day wasn't pure like salt today, so it could by various means lose its saltiness. And if that happened, the remaining product may have had the appearance of salt, but none of the benefits. It could not even be used for fertilizer, as Jesus says. It is fit neither for the land nor for the dunghill or the manure pile. In other words, it's useless in every respect. Jesus is saying that people who follow Him without total commitment are like that salt that has lost its saltiness. They may have the appearance of being disciples, but they cannot be used in the kingdom as a Christian should be used in the kingdom. Jesus is referring to those who only give a part of their lives to Him. They're willing to commit to following Jesus maybe one day a week, but not 7 days a week. They'll commit to obeying Him in their marriage, but maybe not in their finances. They'll give up this thing, but not that thing to follow Jesus. Their half-hearted commitment will not work in the same way that salt that has lost its saltiness is of no use. And so then Jesus concludes, "He who has an ear to hear, let him hear." Hear what? To be a disciple of Jesus, you must be committed to Him above everything else. He said this to remind us of our responsibility to listen and respond to this difficult message. The teaching is not difficult to understand, but it's difficult to accept. There was a cartoon in Leadership Magazine that once ran that showed a church building with a billboard in front that said, "The Light Church," L-I-T-E. the light church. And then underneath it, it is spelled it out. We have 24% fewer commitments. We are home with a 7.5% tithe. We have 15-minute sermons, 45-minute worship services. We have only 8 commandments. Your choice. We use just 3 spiritual laws and have an 800-year millennium. Everything you wanted in a church and less. Now, I like that cartoon because the cartoon presents what I think many people are looking for in a church. But you know what? To follow Jesus, we need to be totally committed. We need to understand what a Christian is as Jesus defined it. The question we need to ask ourselves is not, am I able to follow Jesus completely? But rather, am I willing to follow Jesus completely? I mean, we are all human, and sometimes we will fail in our commitments. But the thing Jesus is confronting here is not ability, but our willingness to follow Him with our whole hearts. For those who are Christians, we need to understand that that's what Jesus wants. He wants our hearts to be totally committed to Him. To be a disciple of Jesus, we must be committed to Him above everything else. This morning, we want to encourage each other because we know the Scriptures make it plain that it's very difficult to live the Christian life. But difficulty leads to blessing. And the blessing of eternal life is found only in those who are disciples of Jesus Christ. Have you decided today to follow Him? If you've decided today to follow Him and you've not yet been baptized into His death, why not do that today? Be baptized into His death, raised to walk in newness of life. All together we stand and sing.